Now, on the face of it, you would not think that James would be a controversial book. I mean, after all, it's not filled with erotica like Song of Songs. Okay, I see you back there pulling the Bibles out and thumbing through them. You can read that later. It's not obsessed with the end of the world like Revelation. But it has been a very controversial book over the centuries, especially since the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther called it an epistle of straw and would have gotten rid of it if he could have. Now, Martin Luther didn't like it in particular because he had broken from the church because of some of the abuses that the church had created based upon doing good works. So he wanted to focus on faith and nothing but faith. James will not leave it there. Oh, he focuses on faith. But for James, you have to show us your faith by doing something. Now, there's dispute about who this author might be, because all he says about himself is, I'm a servant of God, I'm a servant of Jesus Christ, my name is James. Some people attribute that to the brother of Jesus, James. Others suggest, no, it's just another James who happened to be a follower of Jesus. Could have been. But you know what? That stuff doesn't worry me that much. Because at some point the church decided this was an important witness to include. And we're still talking about it after all these years. You know, James is less like a letter than it is like wisdom literature. In a letter, you ordinarily get a greeting and a salutation, and much of that is missing from the book of James. It plunges right into giving you practical advice about how to live out your faith, much like Proverbs. It has more in common with that tradition, really, than with any of the other epistles. Just before the passage that Lisa read, James clearly lets you know that this is an honest writer, because he says, don't blame God for the bad choices you make. God didn't make me go out there and break that gas meter, okay? That was my choice, and it wasn't a good choice. But God didn't make me do it, and the devil didn't make me do it. And James makes that very clear. Our choices are our choices, not because God has tempted us to do it, and not because the devil has made us do it. And then James moves into talking about some of the basic themes that will run through the whole book. How do we live out our faith? How do we make it real in the world? James sees a lot of people who are followers of Jesus who will tell you all you have to do is believe. We still have those, don't we? All you have to do is say the sinner's prayer. That's it. All you have to do is accept Jesus as your personal Savior. That's it. But James disagrees. That's all fine and good. But for James, that's just a first step. Because we do not have a faith that we can keep to ourselves. We have a faith that is to be not just shared in words, but embodied. Lived out. We walk the walk. We don't just talk the talk. And so when James is helping us to find a way to not simply be hearers of the word, that's important. We listen. We listen more than we speak, right? Good advice for preachers. And I guess for everybody else too. We listen more than we speak. But once that listening is done, and once we've taken the word in, once that has been implanted like a seed in our lives, to use his imagery, we then have to do something. We have to live it out. And we have plenty of examples around us of doing the truth, of being doers of the word. Jesus being the primary example, the word made flesh, dwelling among us, walking among us. But there are plenty of others as well. There is a gentleman that we see occasionally. Every now and again, we will go to Wendell Smith's on a Saturday morning for breakfast. And this is confession now. And I love those biscuits and gravy, you know, and everything else that goes with it. And while we're sitting there, frequently sitting across from us or just up at a small booth, usually by himself, he's very distinguished looking, older African-American gentleman, handsome, still in his 80s. The waitress is there. And I know I should say servers, but at Wendell Smith's, they're waitresses. All call him Coach. They all know him. They all call him Coach. And it didn't take long for me to learn who he was. He looked familiar at first, but it wasn't long before I figured out who this man was. And if you don't know his name, or if you didn't before this weekend, I hope you do now. His name is Ed Temple. Ed Temple came to school at Tennessee Agricultural and Industrial College, Tennessee A&I. He came to school here. He had been a star athlete in high school. He came to school here, and if he was going to go to school in Tennessee, that was the only school he was going to go to, because, you see, that was the school reserved for blacks, for African-American students. He would not have gotten into the University of Tennessee. He would not have gotten into MTSU. He would not have gotten into Austin Peay. He would not have gotten into any public university. He would not have gotten into any private university except for Fisk, or if he were a graduate student in medicine, Meharry. So he came to Tennessee A&I. When he graduated, he wanted to do master's work, and they offered him a job. It was a pretty lucrative job, too. He got $150 a month to run the post office as he pursued his master's work, and to coach women's track. He said it was a job nobody else wanted. You understand, this is a time when any self-respecting coach would want to coach men. There were no athletic scholarships for women. Women's sports teams were looked down upon, were held in disdain. These were African American women who were going to be a part of this team. Even more so, we're working our way down the scale here of importance. It was a job nobody else wanted, and Ed Temple took it. Within 5 years, they had won the Amateur Athletic Union Championship, which they went on to do 12 times. 10 years later, Ed Temple was the coach of the women's track team that went to the Olympics. He also did that in 64. His young women, who were known as the Tiger Bells, were winning medal after medal after medal after medal. Remember, without athletic scholarships, from an all-African-American school, having to drive them through the South, and when they had to stop to go to the bathroom, they went to the bathroom in the field because there was no other place for them to go. These Olympic champions. I'm not telling you this to bring you down. I'm telling you this to say, you know, things sometimes must change, and things sometimes can change. He coached that team for 44 years. In that time, 40 of his runners went to the Olympics representing their country. 35 from the United States and 5 from various Caribbean islands who had come to, by then, Tennessee State to run. But according to Ed Temple, the thing he's most proud of is not the fact that they had 40 runners to compete at the Olympics. You would think that would be the primary source of pride. You know what he's proud of? Every single one of those Olympians graduated with one or more degrees. That's what he's proud of. Because you see, that track team was a conduit for young African-American women who had no other alternatives in the world open to them to find a way to get an education, to find a way to continue that education, to find a way to contribute to the world. Ed Temple used his gifts to help other people use their gifts so they could help other people use their gifts. Did you hear what Lisa read at the very end of that? The pure and perfect religion is what? Serving widows and orphans, the lowest of the low. Whenever you hear widows and orphans, think of those who've been pushed aside, those who've been marginalized, those who are considered unimportant. The perfection of our faith is being doers of the word by serving the least of these. That's exactly what Ed Temple spent his entire life doing. Serving the least of these. They put a statue of him up this past Friday. And I think it's about time. We've had plenty of statues of people who have led troops to kill other people. We've had plenty of statues of politicians who have made it to certain levels by whatever means. But how many statues do we have to people who are doers of the word? Who have simply done the truth, who have simply used their gifts to allow other people to use their gifts under the absolute worst of circumstances. Well, we got one now. Thanks be to God, we got one now. And it seems to me that being doers of the word, not hearers only, is not rocket science. It is simply in whatever situation you find yourself, and maybe that's in a job that nobody else wanted, and maybe that's in a job that has no prestige associated with it at first, but we are called to simply use our gifts, to allow others to use their gifts, to allow them to use their gifts, to allow others to use their gifts, and it grows exponentially. That is the gospel. That is being doers of the word. That is how we do the truth. And we do that with the least of these. And we do it by keeping ourselves unstained by the world. Now that has a little different meaning in James. Doesn't have anything to do with our being somehow purer than other people. It has to do with our judging by a different standard than the world's standard. If you ask pretty much anybody in the world what Ed Temple's primary accomplishment was, it was having 40 Olympians. If you ask Ed Temple, he will tell you it's having 40 graduates. Not the standards of the world. We keep ourselves unstained by those, and we judge by the standards of the gospel. It's not that hard. You don't have to have a bishop to lay hands on your head to do this. You don't have to have a board of ordained ministry to proclaim that you have the gifts and graces to be able to do this. You have already been ordained in your baptism to go forth and be doers of the word, to do the truth. And we have the examples to follow. What could be better? Oh, by the way, Ed Temple is also a very active member at Clark Memorial United Methodist Church. Thought I'd throw that in too.